a while back.
Yeah. Thank you. You have the sponsorships?
Oh.
Thank you. Tonight our learning is sponsored by Karen and David Federbush, in memory of David's grandfather, Rav Shimon ben Tzvi, Zichron LeBracha, Andrea and Ben Reishal, in memory of Ben's sister, from Asara, Bas Rav Chaim Yitzchak, Zichron LeBracha, and by Yitzstern, in memory of his mother's Lada, Bas Yitzchak, Zichron LeBracha. Shalom, Shalom, Aliyah. Thank you, Ari. So we've been seeing a piece in Rav Chaim's Sefer al Rambam in Hilchos Yibum HaChalitza. I had mentioned in the past that it's a very fundamental and important piece, and I said that we are going to take the opportunity before we delve into future sugyas, which we, as Hashem will, to take a look at this piece inside. It's not what we usually do in the shiur. Usually we try to do things more conceptually. We usually try to do sugya-based learning. But for a variety of reasons, I think it's a good time to try to take the opportunity to go through this piece, which has become a classic in the literature of the yeshivas. It's like really a must-see piece in terms of the fundamental principles and yesodos that it highlights. So let's do a couple of pieces of background before we jump into the piece itself. First, background on the work that we are studying. What we are looking at right now is Kiddush Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi al Rambam. So you all have copies of my version. This is my Kiddush Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi al Rambam. It is almost always printed in this very large text. That's why you have these large sheets. The briskers tend to be very traditional in their printing. There are actually alternate versions of Chiddush Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi al Rambam, but this was like the original version, and there are variations of it, but this is how it's usually printed, and that's why it's in such a large page. A little background on the man and the work. So Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi refers to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. The man that we often call Rav Soloveitchik was Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik. There were actually several Rav Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchiks. But the man that we call the Rav was a grandson of Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was also known as Rav Chaim Brisker because he was a Rav in the town of Brisk. And he's really one of the most important figures in the last, certainly in the modern era of Jewish history, if not Jewish history in its entirety, in terms of the mark that he left on Klal Yisrael. Now again, we're not going to go into all of his biographical details. Rav Chaim was an amazing person on many levels. Even without any of his contributions in learning, he was an immense Baal Chesed, and that was one of the things he was most proud of. That was what he wanted to be placed on his matzeva. He didn't want anything about his learning to be placed on his matzeva, rather the Chesed that he did. He believed that the role of a communal Rav was to do Chesed. They said that Aniyim were constantly walking in and out of his house like a revolving door. It was almost like a kind of hostel. So that was just on his interpersonal side. In terms of learning, he really revolutionized the world of learning by developing a new, what we would call Derech HaLimud, a new approach to learning that is often referred to as Brisker Lamdus, after Rav Chaim Brisker, which basically took the old system of learning. The old system was known as Pilpul, which was an entirely different way of approaching Limud HaTorah. Pilpul is a very hard method to describe, but it's the kind of thing that you can easily identify when you see it. But we won't get into what Pilpul was right now. What was important is that Rav Chaim had this new way of approaching learning, which was largely conceptual in nature. It was almost scientific in nature in terms of the precision that it sought. At the outset, Rav Chaim was almost mocked for that scientific precision. He was mockingly called a chemist because of the scientific precision that he sought with his method in learning, but it was quickly recognized that he was onto something, and his method in learning caught fire. Rav Chaim himself did not see himself as an innovator. He saw himself as really just returning to the learning methodology of the Rishonim, particularly Rabbeinu Tam and the Ramban. He just saw it as a kind of a revamped version of what the Rishonim were doing. And frankly, if you really understand the nuances of the methodology, you could see that very much. The Balei HaTosfos and the Chachmei Sfar, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva were very much engaged in this, a similar enterprise to what Rav Chaim was engaged in. He introduced new terminology. He introduced new categories or categorical thinking, if you will. And he did it in a very systematic way. And like I said, that ended up catching fire. He gave shiur in the yeshiva of Alajin, which was the first modern yeshiva and the greatest of all the yeshivas. And his shiur just totally, again, caught fire. Everybody was eager to come to his shiur. When he would give shiur, the way it worked in Balazhan is they would rotate the shiurim. It's not that everybody had their own shiur and they would go at their own pace. The yeshiva of Balazhan would start from the first daf in Maseches Brachos. They would go straight through the last daf in Maseches Nida. They didn't have particular Masechtos that they study like most yeshivas do nowadays. They'd really just go through Shas. and whichever Magid Shir, whichever was giving Shir, would pick up wherever the last one left off, and they would have a rotation. They would just go through the through Shas that way. That's how Shir worked in Balazhin. On days when Rav Chaim was giving Shir, you'd think that, like, you know, it was the Super Bowl, Lahavdil. It was not. There was no Super Bowl back then, and at least the Frum Bachram of Balazhin weren't interested in the Super Bowl. But it was very, very exciting. People were clamoring to get into Shir. Like they said, it was standing room only when Rav Chaim was giving Shir. People recognized that it was something new, and it was something important, and there was MS to it, and it was electrifying. And really, many of the Gedolim of the next generation had learned under Rav Chaim in the Yeshiva of Balazhin, whether it was Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, or Mr. Zalman Meltzer, or Rav Chanan Wasserman, or Rav Shimon Shkap, Rav Baruch Ber Leibovich, and I know I'm missing some. There were others. The Brisker Rav, of course, his own sons, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. I'm sorry?
Was the Netziv part of that?
Well, the Netziv was not a Talmud of Rav Chaim. The Netziv was way older than Rav Chaim. He used to give Shir and Balazhin as well. Now, the Shir would alternate between the Netziv and Rav Chaim, and the Netziv Shir was not nearly as popular as Rav Chaim Shir. That was actually a point of contention in the yeshiva, that people sometimes wouldn't go to the Netziv Shir, and they would go to Rav Chaim Shir. He had exceptions. A prominent exception was Rav Kook, who did not really take to Rav Chaim's Derech HaLimud and was a very loyal and devoted Talmud of the Netziv. So you definitely had exceptions. You were dealing with two Gedolei Torah, of course. But Netziv was not a Talmud.
They're very next to each other.
They're very next to each other, correct. Correct. Rav Chaim married the Netziv's granddaughter. Rav Chaim married the Netziv's granddaughter. So they were mishpacha as well.
But he was also in Warsaw, which is where he's buried, because he was sick apparently at the time.
And they ended up in Warsaw, right, exactly. So they're both buried in Warsaw. There was also a question, again, this gets into some of the politics of the time, if you will. There was a question regarding the succession after the Netziv. The Netziv was the last Rosh Yeshiva of Balazhin. So there are all sorts of stories about why the Yeshiva of Balazhin closed. And some of them are more accurate than others. Part of it was a succession crisis. They didn't know who was going to take over. The Talmidim assumed that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik was going to take over, but the Netziv ended up appointing his son instead, Rav Chaim Berlin. Rav Chaim Berlin was a great scholar. There's no question that he was a Roli Talmud Chacham, but he wasn't Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and that's not an insult to Rav Chaim Berlin. There are very few people outside of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik who could reach the heights of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. So they say that the Netziv may have been concerned about just the management of the yeshiva. You have to remember that running a yeshiva back then and now was not just about what a great Talmud Chacham you were and how great a shir you gave. There was a management piece to it also. And they think he was concerned that Rav Chaim, because he was such a tzaddik, used to just, when he would meet an ani, he'd just give away whatever money he had to the next poor person. And the Netziv was, he would never turn away, Rav Chaim was also, would never turn away a Talmud. The Netziv was concerned that the yeshiva would not be able to run on just a purely pragmatic level with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik at the helm. So that ended up being a major succession crisis among the Talmidim. The Talmidim started fighting, and then the Russian authorities, the Tsar got involved, because back then, anytime there was any kind of social unrest, the Tsar was not having it. The Tsar would just shut it down. So that was part of the closing of the yeshiva as well. So that's all, again, so that's all tangential. The Netziv was not a Talmud, but all of those Gedolim that I just mentioned were Talmidim of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. And again, I don't think that was a comprehensive list. There were definitely others that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head. But they ended up learning under Rav Chaim. Now, Rav Chaim, like his children, this became a Brisker tradition as well, was much more fond of teaching than he was of writing. The Briskers traditionally loved teaching. They were heavily invested in their Talmidim, but they didn't really enjoy writing. So again, for us, who have closer proximity to the Rav, to Rav Soloveitchik, that was certainly true. The Rav loved giving shir. I certainly was never in the Rav shir, but you speak to people who were. He was really like in a different realm. He was like in together with the Malachi Asharis when he was in the act of giving shir. But he didn't write very much. Most of what we have in terms of the writings of the Rav are either notes that were taken by Talmidim that were subsequently published, or alternately manuscripts that he wrote but never published during his lifetime. That's most, or transcripts of lectures that he gave. Most of what we have in terms of the Rav's writings take that form. There were certain things that he wrote, certain essays that he wrote for tradition, and we have The Lonely Man of Faith and Halachic Man, and those are, you know, some of the classics that he did write. But most of what we have was not written by the Rav. And that was a Masorah that was in the Brisker family and started with Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim did not write very much. And the little that we do have is either, again, essays that he wrote were published posthumously, or notes on his shiurim. We have two primary svarim from Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. We have what's called the Rav Chaim in Sefer, that's what we're going to be studying tonight, and the Rav Chaim in Stencil. Why is it called the Rav Chaim in Stencil? I don't know. Maybe there was a stencil used to originally publish it, I have no idea, but that's what it's called. The Rav Chaim in Stencil are notes that Talmidim wrote on his shiurim. The Rav Chaim in Sefer are essays that he wrote himself. But once again, they were not published during his lifetime. If you look at the beginning of the Sefer, they were published by his sons posthumously. So what they did is they took the writings of Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim would very frequently work on the basis of the Rambam. He would start, as we're going to see tonight, his starting point was a psak of the Rambam. So they appended those essays to the relevant passages in the Rambam, and they published it as this Sefer, Chidush Rabbi Chaim Halevi al Rambam. Okay? So Rav Chaim's impact is certainly much larger than the Svarim that we have. There are certain very important and classic pieces in this work, but in order to understand his real impact, it's really understood better through his Talmidim than it is through his Svarim. That's just a little bit of background on the Sefer that we're going to study tonight. A little bit of background on the piece that we're going to study, and then we'll do a third piece of background on the particular halacha that we're going to look at. The piece that we're going to study is a very fundamental piece for broad yesodos in Shas as a whole. Rav Chaim is going to start with a very narrow question, but through that narrow question, he's going to identify certain very broad sweeping principles that really animate, without exaggeration, the entirety of the halachic system. And that's a classic feature of the Brisker method. You find an anomaly, a small anomaly within a particular halacha, but that anomaly can reveal very large, important, sweeping principles about halacha as a whole. Again, lahavdil, that's part of the reason why Rav Chaim's methodology was compared to science. Science will sometimes work in the same way. You find a narrow anomaly, but you can use that to identify very large principles. And that is what happens in the Brisker method as well. Our narrow topic that we've been discussing is Eidos L'Kiyum Hadavar. Is Eidos L'Kiyum Hadavar a particular type of Eidos that is needed, as we've seen on Kiddushin and Girushin? And the idea of Eidos L'Kiyum Hadavar that we've been presenting largely emerges from this Rav Chaim, but as we will again see, Eidos L'Kiyum Hadavar is really just one instance or one example of a much larger principle in halacha that he identifies. So now, let's move to the final piece of background, which is background on the particular starting point of Rav Chaim. In Parshas Kisetze, this week's Parsha, the Torah outlines the mitzvos of Yibum and Chalitza. Of Yibum and Chalitza. It's always nice when you're learning overlaps with the Parshas HaShavua. When it's Parshas Kisetze, you better hope it overlaps with the Parshas HaShavua, because if not, there's something wrong with your learning. There are so many mitzvos in Parshas Kisetze. They say that, you know, in general, if your learning overlaps with the Parshas HaShavua, it's a skula. I think with Kisetze, it's the opposite. If it doesn't overlap with the Parsha, then you have a problem. So we have the mitzvos of Yibum and Chalitza. What are the mitzvos of Yibum and Chalitza? So you have a young couple, Rahman al-Atsan, the husband dies young before they have an opportunity to have children. You have this young widow, and the Torah presents two possibilities. Number one, either she can perform the mitzvah of Yibum and essentially marry the brother of the deceased and start a new family and perhaps, you know, continue the legacy of the deceased brother. That's, you know, if we were learning Maseches Yevamos at some point, maybe we will. We'll go through what the Mechayev of the Mitzvah of Yibum is and what it's all about. But that's one avenue. Or alternately, if they're not going to do that, they do something called Chalitza. There's a formal ceremony in Beis Din, famously involves a shoe and some spitting and some verbal declarations, and they dissolve the bonds between them, and she's free to marry somebody else. Nowadays, the Gemara Yevamos Daf Lamed Tes tells us that is the option that we prefer. Ideally, in its pristine form, is the Mitzvah of Yibum better or the Mitzvah of Chalitza better? That's Machlokas Tanoim. But nowadays, we assume that for obvious sociological reasons, Yibum is not the best option nowadays, and therefore nowadays we do Chalitza. Okay? That is the mitzvah of Chalitza. Next. When a Chalitza is done, there are three possibilities to what the result could be. If the Beis Din is competent and they do a proper Chalitza, that's what we call a Chalitza Kshera, intuitively. Chalitza Kshera means that the Chalitza worked, it was effective. The bonds that connected the brother of the deceased and the widow are now dissolved, and she's free to marry somebody else. That's the ideal option, Chalitza Kshera. The polar opposite, if they really botch the whole process, they really mess it up, and it doesn't even resemble a Chalitza at all, that's what we call Eino chalitza. It's just not a chalitza. If you didn't have a shoe, if you didn't have spitting, you didn't know the formal procedure, you didn't have a bezdin, that's just not a chalitza. You could do whatever ceremonies you want. You can knock yourself out. But that's not a chalitza. That's called eino chalitza. In the middle, we have a category called chalitza psula. That's an important category. Chalitza psula is not, as its name implies, eino chalitza. It's not that the chalitza hasn't worked at all. It's worked, but not fully. What does that mean? Chalitza psula is a middle category whereby it hasn't worked to the extent that she can marry anybody else. She's not free. She hasn't been released from her yibum bonds. But it has worked enough that none of the other brothers can do yibum. Once chalitza is done, nobody can do yibum at that point because, again, it's been knocked out as a possibility. So when you have a chalitza psula, you have this middle category whereby the chalitza has been effective on some level to the point that the other brothers can't do yibum, but she's not free to marry anyone else.
Can the other brothers do chalitza?
Can the other brothers do chalitza? Again, chalitza wouldn't be a problem. The iser of Eishes Ach is on yibum, right? In other words, one of the major themes throughout the first parak of Yevamos, this is one of the major yesodos in yibum in general, is that really it's an erva relationship, right? It's what we would call Eishes Ach, or under ordinary circumstances, that's a horrific erva. It's certainly an illicit relationship. Within this narrow context, within these narrow parameters, she can marry the brother. But that's the problem is in the yibum, right? The problem is in the yibum. If there's already been some form of chalitza, then the yibum might not be a mitzvah. It might be the isur, the erva of Eishes Ach.
But I'm talking about marrying somebody else outside the brother. In other words, it's a chalitza basula.
She's not free to marry, right? So again, it works enough to prohibit the other brothers from doing yibum, but not enough to free her to marry. Okay, that's this middle category of chalitza psula. Okay,
what is that accomplished? Why would the Torah do that?
So we'll see. In other words, it may not be that the Torah did that. It might be that it works to Orais and Rabbanan, they instituted that status because they didn't do it properly. Or it might be that they botched it, but not enough that it actually ruins it entirely. Okay? But as we're going to see in a moment, the most likely explanation is it works on a D'oraisa level, but Midrabanan, the Rabbanan weren't happy with it for whatever reason. Again, we'll see examples of this in a moment, and therefore they prohibited it. Okay? Fine. Now, final piece of background before we jump into Rav Chaim. The narrow scenario, the narrow case that we're going to be dealing with is Chalitza without Eidin. As we've been discussing all along, our sugya has been Eidos Lukiyum Adavar. So what about a chalitza that is done without Eidin? There is a Gemara in Yevamos, we'll see it referenced in a moment, Adav Kofei, that says that it deals with a case where the brother, the Yavam, is in jail. He's held in captivity. And you can't bring Eidim into the jail, so he manages to do a chalitza just beino leveino, just between the two of them. That's what that's the Gemara says. Rabbi Akiva says that's a chalitza ksheira. Chalitza works. Implication being, chalitza does not require Eidim. However, the Gemara qualifies and says, really, Rabbi Akiva was only saying that in a case where there were Eidim standing outside looking through the window. Implication being that Eidus is needed. So where does that leave us? It leaves us with Rav Chaim in front of us. Okay, let's take a look at the Pesach of the Rambam, and then we'll look at Rav Chaim's analysis. So Rav Chaim begins with a quotation from the Rambam in Perek Da'alad V'chosib Machalitza Halacha Tesvav. V'chein im chalitza bifnei yachid. So let's say they did a chalitza in front of one witness, but not two. V'afilu beino levena uvalayla. Even if it was just the two of them at night, so really nobody else saw. It was dark, it was just the two of them. Hareza, says the Rambam, chalitza psula. Ad kan l'shom. So the Rambam tells us that if you did a chalitza without Eidim, it's not perfect, but it also works on some level. As we discussed, chalitza psula is that middle category that works on some level, but not fully. And that bothers some of the commentaries on the Rambam. Ayin sham b'lechem mishnah. Look at the Lechem Mishnah's commentary in the Rambam. This is the third line in the Rav Chaim. I'm sorry, I should have specified. We're, of course, starting from where it says Hilchos Yibum Machalitza rather than just the top of the column. So again, I should have specified that before. If you count down three lines after the words Hilchos Yibum Machalitza, you'll see the first word is Lechem Mishnah. So Rashi Tepos. Beis Lamed Ches Mem. So Ayin Sham Lechem Mishnah. Look at the Lechem Mishnah's commentary in the Rambam. Shehikshe, he poses a question on the Rambam. May asugya be yavamos tafkof heyam adbeis. he challenges the Rambam from the Gemara's discussion on Daf Kof Hei Amud Beis. Which discussion? The discussion that we just mentioned. Ahad Esnan, we learned in a Mishnah, Umaisa, fourth line, Be'echad Shechalatz Beino Levena Bevesa Asurim. There was an instance in which somebody did Chalitza just between the Yavam and the Yavama, just between the two of them in a prison in captivity. Ubamaisa Lifnei Rabbi Akiva, and the case was presented to Rabbi Akiva, Ve'echshir, and Rabbi Akiva said it is a perfectly good Chalitza. Ubi Gemara Sham, and the Gemara there qualifies and says, Beino Levena Miadana. The language here is very important, so just file this away. The Gemara's question is, if it happened between the two of them, just between the two of them, how are we ever going to know that it actually happened? So, Amar of Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, the Gemara answers, or Yehuda reports in the name of Shmuel, the Eidim Roen Oso Mibachutz. There are witnesses who see them, who see this Chalitza happening from the outside. So what's the Lech HaMishnah's question on the Rambam? The Imkain, Hare Kosha Al HaRambam. So then the Lech HaMishnah says, so if that's the case, if I read this Gemara properly, then we have a problem with the Rambam. Shekosav hachdina b'stama, v'lo hizkir de'ayri be'edim ro no somi b'chutz. Kim tasa Gemara. The Rambam just said, you do a chalitza without edim, it works on some level. Again, chalitza psula. He did not qualify and say that it's only when there are two witnesses seeing from the outside. In other words, the Lech HaMishnah is saying, based on that Gemara, if you have a chalitza without any witnesses, it should be no good at all. What we called eina chalitza. And yet the Rambam is saying that the chalitza is still effective, does still work on some level. So asks the Lech HaMishnah, how can the Rambam say that the chalitza works without edim? The Gemara specified that you do need edim seeing from the outside. V'tiretz, now Rav Chaim quotes the Lech HaMishnah's own answer, Taha de be'inan sheyihyu edim roen oso. When the Gemara says that you need witnesses seeing from the outside, hainu davka aliba de Rabbi Akiva de machshir. That's only according to Rabbi Akiva, who says that the chalitza is a chalitza ksheira, the highest level of chalitza. Masha ein ken laharambam v'sfira le depasol, as opposed to the Rambam, who says that it's not a fully good chalitza, but only in that middle category that we described, where it's only what we'll call a 50% chalitza. Lahachi lo hevi hach to edim roen oso. That's why the Rambam doesn't say that witnesses see. Da afilu below edim mehimni leposla ala achim, because without edim, that's sufficient, as we said before, to render the other brothers incapable of performing evil. So Lech HaMishnah says, with Edim, it's a perfect chalitza. Without Edim, it's only on tier 2. It's only a half-good chalitza. But Rav Chaim is not fully satisfied with that. The Akati Tzarchian says, this still requires further explanation. Fima Shekosav Anamuka Yosef, the chalitza below Edim, lo havia chalitza. We have another shita in the Rishonim, the opinion of the Muka Yosef, that chalitza without edim is not on that middle tier that the Rambam describes, but rather, it is not a chalitza at all. A chalitza without edim is like a kiddushin without edim. A chalitza without edim is like a gerushin without edim. According to the Muka Yosef, it does not work at all. Im kein, ha'ena poselos oza gamala achin. If that's the case, then it indeed doesn't work at all. Yet the Rambam says that it is somewhat effective without witnesses. Chaim says, look, however you explain the Rambam, we have a machlokas rishonim here. And as we say all the time in Shir, whenever we have a machlokas, it's tzarachian. We need to stop and we need to think about it. The Rambam didn't flip a coin, the Nemuka Yosef didn't flip a coin. Each of them took a principled position on what a chalitza without edim looks like. The Rambam says it is somewhat effective. The Nemuka Yosef says it is not effective at all. And says Rav Chaim, we require some explanation here. Ukvar amdu ha-mefarshim bezed. The mefarshim tried to explain this. But ulay yesh lomar, and maybe the Rambam holds, the sphere lay de'afte mi de'oraisa lo havi chalitza klal, v'chol ze achmur ala de'tipasal ala achin. Maybe this goes back to what we were talking about before, maybe even though the chalitza doesn't work at all, it's a chumra de'rabanan, that the brothers should not be able to perform yiva. Okay, the Ashkachan Hachi Bekama Dukhte, we find this in several places. The Aftami the Oraisa Lohavia Chalitza Klal, we call Makom Achmu Rabbanan Gabad, that they have a Chalitza Psulu Bahachanami Dechavasa. Maybe the answer is it doesn't work at all on the Oraisa level, and all of it is just a Chumra de Rabbanan. Rav Chaim presents that as a possibility. But as we'll see, he thinks there is another alternative in terms of understanding the Rambam. So the background to all of this, before we go any further, is this Machlokas Rishonim. Again, what happens with chalitza without edim? According to the Rambam, it still does seem to work on some level. According to the Nemuka Yosef, it does not work at all. And the question is, why? Any questions on that before we go further?
She's sick or she's not?
Again, she cannot marry someone else. So
she's stuck.
Right. So again, so if you mean right, so zika is one of the critical terms of Yibum. So the zika would still be in place on some level. She can't go to marry someone else. But she's psula ala achim. Again, she can't do Yibum with any of the other brothers. She's stuck in this middle ground, in this middle zone. So they have to obviously do a proper chalitza in order to release her.
So she could do a second chalitza.
Right, exactly. In other words, right now she's stuck. She can't do Yibum and she can't marry somebody else. So what you do is you have to do a proper chalitza in order to release her. Yeah?
Would the Rambam require Adam for Yibum?
Would the Rambam require... No. No.
So why... If there's two avenues...
Great question. Okay, good. You're on the right track. We'll return to that. Okay? Presumably not. We'll get there. Yeah?
What would the Rambam say about... In the Kiddushin, would you say the same thing?
The Rambam would say, as we've seen, the Rambam would say that it's not a good Kiddushin. It's not a Kiddushin at all. No, he's not. Because Chalitza, he's saying it works on some level.
Right. Well, what is Kiddushin? Is there a middle ground by Kiddushin and
Gizis? Again, in theory, you could have had a middle ground by Kiddushin whereby she's not muteras to her husband and she's asura l'kuli alma. In theory, we could have had that. But in any event, it's not... The consistency isn't there insofar as, again, the alternative is not that it would be a perfectly good chalitza. The Nemuka Yosef says that it is not a chalitza at all. Right? So that would be consistent. The Nemuka Yosef holds a chalitza without edim is no chalitza. A Kiddushin without edim is not Kiddushin. And a gerushin without edim is no gerushin, right? So the Nemuka Yosef would be consistent across the board. The Rambam is introducing this exception for chalitza, whereby it is somewhat effective when there are no edim. That's the question that we're going to have to try to answer. Okay? Any further questions? Okay, let's jump into Rav Chaim's analysis. We're now up to the paragraph that begins with the word va'asher. Va'asher, you're a lomar v'dasa Rambam. What it appears to me we could say to explain the Rambam, the svirale de lo be'inon mi de'oraisa edim klal gabe chalitza. The Rambam holds that on a de'oraisa level, we do not need witnesses at all on a chalitza. And what would be the question on that? How can the Rambam say mi de'oraisa we don't need witnesses at all on a chalitza? Before we get into ein davar she'ever pachas mishnayim, okay, again, that's an outside knowledge. Even just based on what we saw tonight, what would be the problem with that? We saw Gemara in Yivamos and Daf Kofei, in which Rabbi Akiva said, it's only good when there are witnesses from the outside. So how can the Rambam say there are no witnesses? So here, if you remember before, I told you the language of the Gemara is critical. Look at what Rav Chaim says. So if you pay close attention to the words of the Gemara in Yivamos, you get the impression that edim are actually not necessary. How do you do that, Rav Chaim? We'll see. Deparech beino levena mi yadana. Rav Chaim says, when the Gemara is considering a case where there's chalitza without witnesses, what is the problem that the Gemara poses? Does the Gemara say, how can there be a chalitza without witnesses? Chalitza doesn't work without witnesses? Was that the question of the Gemara? No, the question of the Gemara was, mi yadana. How will we know? Who's going to prove that there was a chalitza? Now again, if you're thinking in the categories that we've been developing over the last several weeks, you'll already realize that mi yadana is a question that doesn't seem to be about edus kiyum, but rather about Edei Biror. This is a question about how we can certify that a fact took place, not that those witnesses were necessary in order for the halachic result to go into effect. Fourth line. The implication of the Gemara, if you read the Gemara carefully, is that the chalitza would actually be good without witnesses. The problem would only be one of verification, of dissemination of the information. It's not a problem in terms of the actual halachic effect. And now here, Rav Chaim introduces his yesod. It's conveniently underlined. That's only because I underlined it in my version, and you all have copies of my version. But here's where Rav Chaim introduces his yesod. The reason for this appears to be the following. We have two different types of testimony b'davar sheva erva. I'll just parenthetically note before we go any further. This whole notion of trei gavne is what we often call in tzvei dinim, is what we often call tzvei dinim in again the parlance of the yeshivos. And it's a classic Prisker construct. There are two different conceptual principles here. Two things may look the same, but tzvei dinim means there are two different conceptual principles operative, even though from the outside it all looks like one general phenomenon. That's the notion of tzvei dinim. I remember this distinctly. When I was in 10th grade, I had a Rebbe who used the term Prisker Lamdus. He was a very good Rebbe, but I remember asking him what Prisker Lamdus is, and he said, Prisker Lamdus is Gavra Chefza and Tzvedinim, is what he said. So those are constructs that are often employed by Prisker Lamdus. It doesn't really capture what Prisker Lamdus is. Prisker Lamdus is an approach towards Limud HaTorah. It's a conceptual approach to Limud HaTorah. Those happen to be two constructs that are often employed within Prisker Lamdus. Gavra Chefza, not even so frequently, but it's just become, like, again, a larger-than-life construct. So they've almost become identified with the Prisker method itself. When you see those words, trei gavne, matzinu trei gavne, idios, b'davar sheba'erva, Rav Chaim is telling us there are two witnesses standing there. And the witnesses might look the same to the untrained eye. But he's telling us those two witnesses could be operating through two alternative conceptual constructs. What are they? So we're on the second underlined line after the comma. Diviz nos hare kaim alon dlo ibru sahade ela lashakre. When it comes to znus, when it comes to an act of infidelity, why do we need witnesses there? The term the Rav Chaim uses is lo ibru sahade ela lashakre, a term that we've seen in the past. They are there to clarify what happened, to determine that something took place. Chumavur b'ksubastav test, tev emes ne'aseres gam below edim. The Gemara ksubastav test, we're not going to get into that now, that's a very rich Gemara. But the Gemara Ksubas there clarifies that even if there weren't witnesses, she should be Asura. Is it that the witnesses are there in order to create the halachic status of Eishes Ish, of infidelity? No, we just need the witnesses there to prove that it happened. But it was the act itself that created the problem. It was the act itself that created the Isser. By contrast, Rav Chaim says, Uvegitin v'kidushin, al yedei ha'edim hu shemekayim ha'milsa. When it comes to Gitin, when it comes to Kiddushin, it is the Edim themselves who create the halachic result. As we establish in halacha that if you do a Kiddushin or a Gerushin without witnesses, it is not going to be a good Gerushin or Kiddushin. Now, why, the question that Rav Chaim now addresses is why? Why is it that sometimes you have this Edus L'Kiyum HaDavar, and sometimes you do not? And here again is where he introduces these very fundamental principles that animate halacha in its entirety.
What's the problem with that? Any isser you could do as long as no
Eden? No, but that it wouldn't create the step. He's not dealing with the isser. It's certainly usser. He's dealing with the isser to her husband. In other words, we have a principle. That's what the Gemara Ksubas Daf Test talks about. Kashem she'asur la'ba'al kach asur la'bo'al. That when she has an affair with someone else. Exactly. But Rav Chaim is saying the only reason for that is simply because we haven't proven that it took place. Fundamentally, you know, the infidelity itself makes her asura to her husband. If she knows that she had an affair, then she is asura to her husband. And the lack of edim does not create that iser. That's what Rav Chaim is pointing out.
Miyadana, right? It's the inverse. We'll say Miyadana, she knows. Miyadana, right. In this case, they know.
In the case of Chalitza.
Yeah.
So what effectively you're saying, Ed, is that Chalitza is more similar to an act of znus, I don't mean in terms of the act itself, is more similar halakhically to an act of znus than it is to gerushin v'kiddushin. That is what you're arguing, and that is what Rav Chaim is going to argue too. The question is why. So we're not going to get to all of it now. Again, Bez Hashem will pick up with this next week. Let's at least finish the first underlined section. V'achiluk shebeinehem ha'heve. And if you want to know the difference between gerushin and kiddushin, which require edus, and other things that do not, and the Edom are only there to clarify what happened, here's the distinction. When it comes to znus, where the isur, the prohibition to her husband, is an automatic result of the maisa znus, therefore, as a result of that, the only purpose of witnesses is to clarify that the act happened. Masha ein kein begitin v'kiddushin, to ha ba'al hu she'osa etzem ha'gerushin v'ha'kiddushin. Gerushin and Kiddushin are different. There, it is not a result of the act, but it is a result of the parties who are engaged in the act. And therefore, the Isser and the Heter require Edus L'Kiyumei Milsa. So again, we're going to continue next week, but let me try to unpack what Rav Chaim just said. In halacha, and this is why I said this is, again, just a broad principle that animates much of halacha in general, there are two types of activities that can create a halachic result. Some are a result of just the physical act itself. Forget any players, forget any consciousness, the physical act itself creates a result. In other instances, it is the context that is provided by the actors that creates a halachic result. Let me give you an example. And I'm going to try to give an example that has an almost identical action, but exists on two different planes. Let's say someone takes an object, picks it up a few tefachim, and puts it back down. Okay? That's the physical act that we're dealing with. Picking up an object, let's say moving it over a little bit, because that will make my example easier, so just for simplicity's sake, and putting it back down. Now, that simple physical act can have halachic ramifications in several contexts. But the contexts, even though, again, the act appears similar, are actually functioning in very different ways. Let's explore. So let's say a person does that on Shabbos. There's no Eruv. They pick up an object. They do what's called an Akira. They move it across, let's say, the border of Rosh HaYachad to Rosh HaRabim, and they put it down. That's called a Hanach. Okay? They have done an act that has violated Shabbos. That's the Malacha of Hotzah. And they violated Hilchos Shabbos in that way. That's one act. That same act, if we move to a different area of halacha, can be used for kinyanim, or something called a kinyan hagbah, where you pick up an object, and by picking up an object, you actually acquire it. You acquire the object. So in both cases, you have the same physical action, and in both cases, you have a halachic result. There's a very fundamental difference between them. In the context of Shabbos, the act of picking something up and putting it down itself constitutes a violation of Shabbos. It doesn't matter whether you intended to or not. That might impact the punishment, whether it's mezid or shogig and things like that. The violation of Shabbos is just that you've taken an object from Rosh HaYachad to Rosh HaRabim. It's not a function of you, your intent, the intent that you invest into this activity. The activity itself has halachic ramifications and halachic results. By contrast, when it comes to kinyanim, that act of picking it up is meaningless in and of itself unless I have intent to acquire, unless I have da'as kona. If I just picked up your object because I thought it was interesting and I wanted to look at it, and then I put it back down, has it somehow become mine? Of course not. The act is only vested with halachic significance when the parties who are at play indeed vest it with that halachic significance, because they say, oh, I intend to give something to you, I intend to acquire something from you, and then they perform that act, which becomes a halachically significant act by virtue of the conscious intent that they install in it. Rav Chaim says, Kiddushin and Gerushin are an example of the latter. It's a case where the act of putting the ring on a woman's finger is not inherently an act of halachic significance. It could just be that she's trying it on. It could just be that he's giving her a present. There's no inherent halachic significance to that act. What makes it significant is the da'as, is the intent of the chasan and the kala, of the groom and the bride, to engage in an act of kiddushin. They are, in essence, creating a halachic result. Yes, there is a physical activity that accompanies it. But if you're asking what the real motivator, what the real mover of the halachic result is, it is them. It is their das. It is their intent that is channeled through an action. By contrast, when it comes to znus, it doesn't matter what the motivation was, again, it could just been a crime of passion, or it could have just been, whatever the case may be, whatever backstory there was to the znus, it doesn't matter. It is that act itself, it is the maisa itself, that creates and constitutes a violation of the sanctity of the marriage, and therefore creates a prohibition, an isser to the husband. In the context of kinyanim, it is the da'as of the parties that invest the activity with significance. In the context of Shabbos, the activity has significance in and of itself. Rav Chaim argues that Eidos L'Kiyum HaDavar is only necessary on activities where it is actually the actors, the parties, that are creating the halachic result, not the Maisa itself. When it's just the physical activity, then the only role of witnesses is to tell us that the physical activity took place. When it comes to an act of, again, where the halachic act where the actors are creating the halachic result through their intent, that's when you need Eidos L'Kiyum HaDavar. Why? This goes back to our analysis before. Because Rav Chaim argues that the purpose of Eidos L'Kiyam HaDavar is to strengthen the Das, formalize, concretize the halachic act. And Rav Chaim will argue as we go forward that Chalitza is just about the activity. It's about the physical activity. Once it's been done, the Chalitza has been achieved, and therefore the Rambam passes that I can work without Eidim. As opposed to Gerushin V'Kiddushin, where the halachic act is not a function of the physical act itself, but rather of the consciousness, the Das, the intent of the parties that are involved. We will, Ezra Shem, continue to develop this as we go forward.